Welcome. You are listening to Aftersight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for the Christian Science Monitor, read by Daniel Williams. Today, we will be reading the following main articles. Article number 1, I Eat the Elite for Breakfast. Argentina's Javier Milei wants radical disruption. Article number 2, This is Fun, How Zoo School Helps Teens Prep for Careers and College. And following up with miscellaneous articles. Our first article, I Eat the Elite for Breakfast, Argentina's Javier Milei Wants Radical Disruption. This article was written by Howard LaFrenchie. Javier Milei. This article was written by Howard LaFrenchie. Javier Milei, Argentina's libertarian president, who came into office last December promising to take a chainsaw to the state, is giving his audience of elites the show they came to see. He's speaking to a gathering of the business organization Council of the Americas in a hotel ballroom with gold leaf and chandeliers. The shaggy-haired economist, a former social media influencer and foul-mouthed TV commentator known as El Loco or the Madman, is once again trumpeting the themes that brought him to the presidency. Argentina in this century has had the worst political administrations in the world. If this were not true, I would not have won, Mr. Milei says with a devilish grin. The audience, the upper crust of Argentine industry and commerce, laughs and applauds. The president reminds them that he thinks big when it comes to changing Argentina's long-standing policies. The only area in which he doesn't think big, however, is the size of the government. He calls himself a minarchist, a libertarian term meaning someone who believes the state's only vital function is to provide the security that citizens need to exercise personal freedom. Since coming into office, Mr. Milei has eliminated 9 of 18 ministries. He's cut back the extensive subsidies on everything from electric bills and gasoline to health care, services that an estimated 60% of Argentines receive. His goal is to fundamentally deregulate an economy that international economists consider to be one of the most regulation-burdened in the world. Governing under the slogan, No hay plata, there is no money, Mr. Milei has delivered the first government surpluses in decades. He's also reduced his country's recent hyperinflation, arguably the single most important factor in his landslide victory last October, from over 200% annually to about 4% a month. Not only has he undertaken the biggest economic adjustment Argentina has ever known, he claims, but it is actually the biggest in the whole history of humanity. Indeed, Mr. Milei has made it clear since moving into the Casa Rosada, Argentina's deep pink version of the White House, that his ambition is vaunting. After he delivers Argentina from the clutches of socialist statism and woke progressivism, he wants his country to be an example not just for a Latin America prone to leftward swings, but for the rest of the world as well. Milei believes he's something like a trigger for a new wave of right-wing leadership across the Americas, says Ariel Gonzalez Lavaggi, director of the Center for International Studies at Pontifical Catholic University of Argentina. Actually, he envisions himself as more than that. He believes he's the most important right-wing and pro-freedom leader of this moment who's going to save the West. Barely had the bachelor Mr. Milei settled his 4 beloved mastiffs into their new presidential home when he flew out to Davos, Switzerland last January to goad the world's powerful with his anti-elites message. As president of Argentina, he has also attended the American Conservative Union CPAC meetings in the United States and Brazil. He has lashed out against socialist Latin America and Western leaders, from Brazil's Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva to Britain's Labour Prime Minister Keir Starmer. His oft-repeated pledge to make Argentina great again is widely seen as a sign of admiration for Donald Trump. Yet he presents himself first and foremost as a devotee of America's global leadership, in sharp contrast with the past decade of mostly leftist Argentine leadership that often seems smitten with Beijing and Moscow. At his Council of the Americas appearance, President Milei pouts playfully that his global stardom is not adequately appreciated in his home country. It's interesting, the whole world sees the Argentine miracle, except for Argentines, he says, peering for effect over his dark-rimmed glasses. Despite his bravado and flair for rocking an audience, Mr. Milei, a former lead singer for a Rolling Stones cover band, seems to understand he's on an unforgiving political clock. He acknowledges that the people can't wait forever for economic relief from the pain of his radical budget cuts. Indeed, as he pursues his relentless transformation of Argentina, Mr. Milei and others question how long its people, who have seen less money in their pockets since his policy adjustments, can hold on for an economic turnaround. Would-be reformist presidents of the past have long tried and failed to extricate Argentina from decades of economic boom and bust cycles. But perhaps most daunting for Mr. Milei is the prospect of transforming Argentina's ingrained leftist populism. Will the people accept such a radical transformation from a society in which the state provided a social safety net and employed thousands to one in which individuals unshackled from the state pull themselves up with their own bootstraps? For many Argentines on the left, Mr. Milei is seen as a blip in their country's history, a man with crazy ideas and reforms that will ultimately fail. They point to the example of Brazil, where right-wing president Jair Bolsonaro was voted out in 2022 after one term in favor of the progressive former president, Mr. Lula. But others say this time could be different. With less than a year in office, Milei has surprised many doubters by accomplishing a list of significant changes, starting with reaching and sticking to a zero deficit, says Juan Luis Boer, chief economist at Fundación de Investigación Económica Latinoamericana, a nonpartisan think tank in Buenos Aires. What Milei has started is a process that could lead to the regime change he has in his sights. But it's a process that will require years of turbulence and hardship before it can succeed, Mr. Boer says, noting that this year the economy will likely shrink by 4%. The key will be how long people can hold on before they decide this regime change isn't for them after all. Martin Krauss, a libertarian economist who taught alongside Mr. Milei at the University of Buenos Aires, cites two reasons he believes this time Argentina's radical economic shift might last. For one thing, Milei didn't spring his intentions on Argentines after he won. He campaigned on them, carrying around that chainsaw wherever he met voters, says Dr. Krauss. That tells me he has a mandate. He also points out that polls show Mr. Milei retaining about the same level of support that gave him the presidency, even after months of economic hardship stemming from his zero deficit mantra. Argentines aren't libertarians, says Dr. Krauss, but they seem to be willing to continue with Milei's version of it if it means ending the assistance politics of the past decade and chopping down an overgrown state. Mr. Malay's ideas are starting to confront a vigorous pushback, however, with only 15% of seats in Congress held by his Libertad Avanza coalition. Mr. Malay saw his zero deficit budget proposal roundly rejected when he presented it personally to Congress in September. His vision for Argentina would also be a stark cultural shift away from the state-supported populism that began about 80 years ago under the government of Juan and Eva Perón. But the Argentine people were desperate to banish the nightmare of hyperinflation, so even modest economic improvement could make Mr. Milei more than a one-term president, some say. The answer is simple, says Dr. Gonzalez. If Milei can deliver a stable economy and growth in a way that doesn't lead at the outset to too much decline in the living standards of the popular classes, he will win. His libertarian ideology and visions of a cultural revolution are a different matter, he says. But if he's successful in his economic management, we'll have Milei for a long time. Like Trump's, President Milei's aggressive style draws young men. Liam Toman is beaming as he offers a peek at a video on his phone. It's as if he were sharing a glimpse of a pearl of great price. In the clip, which was recorded by Mr. Toman's mother on a Buenos Aires street in 2018, a man recognizable as Javier Milei says hello to the young man. The future president of Argentina had just been told Mr. Toman is a great admirer of his. The social media personality and self-described anarcho-capitalist then shouts his signature slogan into the camera, "Long live freedom, damn it!" As it turns out, the slogan captured the mood of young men like Mr. Toman across the country. Young people, and in particular young men not normally prone to political activism, remain an enthusiastic part of Mr. Malay's base of support. I think it's the rebel in Malay that attracted so many young male Argentines in the first place, says Mr. Toman, now a 20-something freelance sound engineer. And then it was his ideas about the need to free Argentina from the status quo of a suffocating state and a stagnant economy that made them his political base. Seated in a busy coffee shop in the capital's upscale Belgrano neighborhood, he underscores what intrigued him most about Mr. Milei when he first saw the outspoken economist on the panel of a TV show called Los Intratables, or The Misfits, in 2017. I was only 16, but he talked about things that made sense to me, like how the political class was only interested in having us pay for their privileges, or how the only way for ambitious young people to get ahead was to leave the country, he says. Hearing someone who said what I was thinking gave me hope. It also didn't hurt that Mr. Milei was a growing social media presence at the time, extending his iconoclastic ideas on a medium frequented by young men, but that largely remained unknown to their parents. The young people are always rebels, but up to this point, being a rebel generally meant being a leftist, says Dr. Kraus, who teaches at the University of the Center for Macroeconomic Studies. What's new now is that to be a rebel is to be a libertarian. Mr. Taman pinpoints Mr. Malay's war on La Casta, or what he calls the self-serving political caste. He also emphasizes the president's unflagging determination to drastically downsize the state as a primary reason he and most of his friends support Mr. Milei. Many young Argentine women remain skeptical of Milei. An Argentine soccer fanatic, Mr. Thomas, dismisses the idea that young men are flocking to Mr. Milei because he rails against the social dangers he believes feminism poses, or that they are reacting to the prominent role young women played in legalizing abortion in Argentina in 2020. Don't forget that Milei calls his sister the boss, he says, referring to Karina Milei, for whom Mr. Millay abolished an anti-nepotism policy in order to make her his chief of staff. The current vice president and security minister are also both strong women, Mr. Thomas says. While younger women may have been reluctant to support such a brash anti-feminist at first, they now see he's not a misogynist, and they are turning more supportive all the time. Some recent polls suggest that this is true, but many young Argentine women remain skeptical at best of what a Milei presidency means for the future. Before Mr. Milei's election, there was a real fear that all of our gains won through the feminist movement were going to be lost, and now that he's president, we are seeing evidence of that regression, says Marcela de la Cruz, a senior studying international relations at the National University of San Martin in a working-class suburb of Buenos Aires. She cites Mr. Millay's abolition of the only recently created Ministry of Women as just one example of how the new president is setting women back. Millay is all about turning back to the traditional ways, she says. Beyond issues of women's rights, Ms. De La Cruz says the Milei presidency promises a hardening of society that will affect all Argentines, not just women. Solidarity is a feminine quality, but it's not something that is valued by this government, she says. Instead, Milei is all about individualism and governing with a firm hand. Those are more masculine qualities, she adds. So maybe that's why so many young men were attracted to him. Young men are also attracted to Mr. Millay as much for his style as for his message, says Marcelo Duclos, a libertarian economics writer in Buenos Aires. And while Mr. Millay's social media presence was critical to his emergence as a political leader, Mr. Duclos says it was television and radio that first gave the president a platform to share his ideas. It was the traditional media that let the Milei genie out of the bottle, says Mr. Duclos, also an amateur bass guitarist. And then his ratings were so high that it became impossible to put him back in that bottle. The economics writer got to know Mr. Milei within Argentina's few scattered circles of libertarian thinkers about a decade ago. He still has the president's WhatsApp number in his phone. This past May, before Mr. Milei launched his new book at the venue Luna Park, Buenos Aires' version of Madison Square Garden, Mr. Duclos reached out to his fellow libertarian. My first thought was, no, 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 a conventional book launch is too boring for either Milei or Luna Park, he recalls. So I WhatsApped Javier and I said, hey, how about we open this book event with a rock concert? The president responded, great idea. Let's do it. Days later, the Argentine head of state let loose on Luna Park stage, dressed in a black leather jacket, prancing back and forth like a mutton chop Mick Jagger. Mr. Milei whipped 10,000 cheering fans into a frenzy, belting out his own version of the song Panic Show by the Argentine hard rock group Laringa. It's become the president's signature song. I'm the king. I'm the lion. I eat the elite for breakfast, he roared to a rapturous audience, raising his arms and headbanging to a screaming guitar solo. After this rocking opening, Mr. Milei changed his clothes, donning a suit jacket before presenting his new book, Capitalism, Socialism, and the Neoclassical Trap, to his audience, mostly men under age 30. Argentine farmers, how long before Milei's economy gets better? Two cousins, Maximiliano Falcó and Juan Ignacio Falcó, are chattering about Mr. Milei as they give a seed-sowing tractor a tune-up. The planting season is approaching. They work for the Minapa Agricultural Services Company not far from Pahuajo, a city of about 40,000 inhabitants in the Argentine Pampas. I would say that Milei didn't win the election. The politicians of the last 20 years lost it, says Maximiliano Falcó, as he inspects the seeding funnels that will now sow soybeans, sorghum, and sunflowers in some of the richest soils on the planet. Once it came down to either more of the disaster we were living through or the change promised by this crazy Malay guy, people gambled and made their choice. Juan Ignacio Falco furrows his brow, indicating he sees things a little differently. I would say all of Malay's talk about freedom made a difference for a lot of people, says the taller and lankier cousin. The idea of freedom from the heavy taxes that were killing us was attractive generally, the tractor mechanic says. But for us farmers, Malay's talk of free trade made sense. I know I prefer that we open up and work with the world in freedom. The cousin's words are tinged with a bitter and widespread sentiment. Argentina's political class has been wasteful and corrupt. Many believe it's impoverished their country and prevented it from advancing on a par with more prosperous neighbors like Uruguay and Chile. How is it possible that a country of such wealth can't even build a decent highway to get our products to the market? Says Maximiliano Falco, referring to the dangerous truck-clogged national highway between Puajo and Buenos Aires and seaports. It remains a two-lane country road despite decades of promises to expand it. Agricultural exports, including the Pampas's renowned grass-fed beef, made Argentina a global breadbasket in one of the world's wealthiest countries a century ago. But recent Peronist governments, which typically had a more urban political base, imposed stiff export taxes on agricultural products, a failed effort intended to bring down domestic food prices and fill government coffers. These policies made farmers furious. In protest, many regularly drove their tractors to the gates of Casa Rosada in Buenos Aires. Despite the ire of farmers and other rural Argentines, the majority of people of Puajo, a farming center about 230 miles east of the capital, still voted for Peronist candidates. Yet, Mr. Milei did a lot better than conservative candidates of the past. Many farmers and business owners in the area say they sense that support for the libertarian economist has gone up over his initial 9 months in office. They also say his rising support reflects the influence of young Argentines on their elders. My 20-year-old daughter was Malay early on, and at first I told her, "How can you vote for him if you also support women's rights?" says Carlos Diaz, who has a 330-hectare family farm along with other parcels of farmland he rents to others. But it was the young people's enthusiasm for Malay's vision of radical change that got him through the primary round, he says. By the general election, I was on board in telling people I had been for Malay all along. Other agricultural workers who support Mr. Malay say they realize his policies will take time. Once he got in office, he confronted certain realities, like he couldn't eliminate all the taxes he'd like to in one fell swoop, says Javier Pinto Kramer, the Puajo branch of the Enrique Bella Casal Crop Seed and Fertilizer Company. Farmers are optimists. We plant seeds and have great faith that the cycle will deliver abundant crops, he says. And we have patience for that cycle to work. Right now the country is in patience mode, but many people are hurting, so I'm not sure how long they can wait. Argentina's public servants, Malay makes us feel like parasites. On a recent Saturday at the National University of San Martin, kids are playing games on the lawn and parents are lining up for snacks at a carnival marking the National Day of Childhood. This commuter school in Buenos Aires serves mostly working-class families, but the revelries take place a day after the government released data showing 2/3 of Argentine children now live in poverty, and nearly 20% are, in fact, destitute. Those figures stun and embarrass many people here. Argentina has long prided itself on having a larger middle class and stronger safety net system than most of its Latin American neighbors, and most of them blame President Milei. These child poverty statistics reveal a very sad and shameful number, says Pablo Faturis, an architect from nearby San Andreas, who's enjoying the festival with his wife and two children. Overall, Argentina's poverty rate has soared to almost 53% in the first 6 months of Mr. Milei's presidency, according to the government statistics agency in a September report. This is the highest poverty rate in two decades, as 3.4 million Argentines have been pushed into poverty this year. While he agrees something had to be done to fix the economy, Mr. Futuris says having children pay the price of the president's economic experiment is not right. Many of the festival's attendees are public employees in education and health services. There's an underlying feeling that the libertarian president views them more as parasites than as public servants. This government treats us as if we're robbing the country and making it poor. But I can't go along with this idea that those who are educating Argentina's children and caring for the sick should pay for this difficult economic adjustment, says Juan Martín de la Cruz, an administrator at the university. Mr. Milei's idea is that we must suffer now for economic growth at some point in the future, Mr. de la Cruz says. But where is that point? At first, he told us the economy would perform like a V with a quick turnaround, and then it became a U with a longer downturn before recovery, he says. But I'm starting to believe it will be an L with no real recovery. The university here was created 35 years ago on a shuttered industrial site. It boasted such departments as nanotechnology and biotechnology, which were supposed to assist in the rebirth of San Martin. Today, however, the campus is dotted with abandoned construction sites, attesting to years of economic decline. Large banners on the university's gates protest Mr. Milei's draconian cuts to higher education. Lucia Vincent, a political scientist at the National University of San Martin, says if Argentina voted to take a chance with Mr. Milei, it was more a vote of punishment against the political class that allowed the economic decline of the last two decades than a sign of faith in Mr. Milei's libertarian economic vision. People were desperate for change, and Milei promised that, she says. So now people are willing to give him the time he needs to get the economy working again. But how much time? He has brought inflation down, and people understand that, Dr. Vincent says. But on the other hand, there is no rise in economic activity and no real job creation. It's a ticking time bomb. Amid the screams of joy at the childhood carnival at the university, a minority of voices speak up for the Milei revolution, as painful as it is proving to be. The adjustment is hurting all of us, our electricity bills and the cost of public transport to get to our jobs are way up, says Rocio Arevalo, a part-time housekeeper who's attending the festivities with her family. But it's true what Mr. Milei says, that a lot of people didn't work and lived off the state, Miss Arevalo says. It's good to help people, she says, but it's also good that people know now that they have to work. Damien, a father of two and owner of a small food services business in San Martin, confirms he voted for Mr. Milei, but he declines to give his last name, suspecting he's among the few at the carnival who did. The truth is, it's a change that had to happen, Damien says, keeping an eye on his two children. The biggest change is Milei saying, no hay plata, and sticking to it, unlike the other governments that spent what we didn't have. Still, he says the lack of money in pockets has made this the hardest year yet for his business. And that does test his faith in the Milei revolution. He worries that in a similar way, families are losing hope in the promised turnaround. I'm really not sure how long people will be able to hold on. Our next article is, This is Fun, How Zoo School Helps Teens Prep for Careers and College. This article was written by Ira Porter. It's just about 8:30 on a Sunday, Tuesday morning, and Kaylin Roosh is all smiles. She is eager to traverse familiar terrain, the Columbus Zoo and Aquarium. The zoo doesn't open for another 30 minutes, which gives her plenty of time to film a keeper talk, an informational video about an animal. Kaylin and her project partner, Maddie Hell, wrote and edited the script. They and another student, Maddie Homan, walk to the Asia Quest exhibit and find the red pandas, mother Cora and daughter Santi. As the furry animals scurry in and out of sight and up a small tree, Kaylin and her partner take turns giving fun facts about the tiny duo. Did you know that red pandas have to eat at least 20% of their body weight each day to survive? Or that the endangered animal's diet is mostly bamboo shoots and leaves? They finish shooting and beseech viewers to get involved with animal conservation. Their next stop is a visit to the palace cat enclosure, where tiny 2-month-old twins cuddle with their mother. I've known since age 5 I'm going to work in a zoo, Kaylin says exuberantly. Her mother told her about this zoo opportunity when she was in the 5th grade. She applied in high school and earned a spot in the program run by the zoo and the Delaware Area Career Center, or DAC, which offers career and technical training support for high schoolers and adult learners. Students enter DAC through a lottery, and there's a waiting list with parents hungry to send their children there. Zoo School, as it's called, is one of a plethora of programs from the center. It's also part of something that Ohio schools champion, career and technical education. And over the past 50 years, CTE has come a long way from woodshop. The zoo opportunity is an example of modern CTE, where young people get exposure in high school to career skills and mentors and a jump on a profession. But these days, that doesn't mean that they're not going on to college. Most, if not all, of the zoo school students will pursue degrees. I would say there was a stigma in career tech education, and I think to a certain extent, there still is a little bit of a stigma, not on the part of the students, but on the part of the families, says Jay Perota, superintendent of DAC. He points to the wait list for zoo school as a broader shift in a parental mindset. I think parents are starting to realize that there's not just one path for success in the future, Mr. Perota says. Parents now see that CTE programs prepare students for college and career, he adds, and in Ohio, the proof is in the pudding. A shift in thinking on CTE. Since it was founded in 2005, Zoo School has graduated 450 students. DAC officials say students have gone on to pursue careers in zoology, human or animal medicine, conservation, and ecology education. Some graduates who began careers in caring for wildlife have come back to speak to students. One owns a media company that specializes in filming endangered animals around the world. Recent statistics back up the idea that CT works, says Shane Spaulding, a senior fellow and managing director of the CTE CoLab at the Urban Institute in Washington. The enrollment trends point to a shift in how CTE programs are perceived. Students are interested in focusing on careers in high school, and dual enrollment gives them the opportunity to get started on their careers at that age, Mr. Spaulding says. In Ohio, career technical planning districts, which organize requirements and offer programming for high school students, are celebrating 50 years. Today, 91 districts exist. Leaders in this Rust Belt state realized that workers had a skills deficit, with more jobs than trained people to fill them. Politicians reflected on the once vibrant economy of tradespeople who had mastered vocational skills and why education had moved away from teaching it. In 2014, the state's then governor, Republican John Kasich, signed an education reform bill making Ohio one of the only states that required CTE courses for middle school students. Support for CTE was enhanced under that law, HB 487, which required having advisors for CTE students, course outlines for middle school students, and a modification to state graduation requirements that allowed multiple pathways to graduation, including recognizing industry credentials that students earn through CTE. Republican Governor Mike DeWine also has increased money for training in schools and equipment. The budget for 2024-2025 allocated $100 million in equipment upgrades, instructional materials, facilities, and operational costs. Schools across the state apply for the grant money. The stipulation is that they must offer a qualifying CTE program for careers listed on Ohio's top jobs list, or a qualifying credential program from the Innovative Workforce Incentive Program. An additional $200 million was earmarked for the Career Technical Construction Program in 2023. The money will be used to expand classrooms and training centers. This will result in more than 3,700 seats for students in programs like construction, engineering, manufacturing, healthcare, and operations. I think over time, as our economy has changed in this country, that people, parents, students, employers, educators have come to the realization that career technical education reinforces academic learning. It doesn't keep you from going on to a four-year degree, and it also enriches the students, says Margaret Hess, Executive Director for the Ohio Association of Career Technical Superintendents. Ms. Hess says that people realize that college isn't the only place where someone can learn marketable skills to make a decent living. This is fun. Zoo School for high school juniors and seniors happens in two phases. During both years, students split their time between classroom learning and zoo activities. The first year, they do two college-level research projects on animals. They observe them with zookeepers, gather data, take a statistics class, learn to compile data, and write research papers, and present their findings. Senior year is more hands-on. They still do in-class learning twice a week with instructor Emily Cunningham, a science teacher by trade. Here, they learn details of animals, habitats, and behaviors. Students also spend time prepping animal habitats, learning about animal diets and general animal care, and getting food ready. They aren't typically allowed to feed animals for safety reasons, but can observe. They started this school year learning about enrichment, stimulation for animals and tools placed into their habitats. Students tried to design their own toys or activities. If approved, zookeepers allowed them to see animal reactions to their creation or to monitor enrichment that full-time keepers place in habitats. The goal is to get them exposed to what two different possible careers could be like, that they want to do someday when they are finished with the program, Ms. Cunningham says. She says she has seen students go on to become veterinarians or work in zoos, as well as become teachers. Ms. Hess sees the benefit of CTE as a no-brainer in places like Ohio. CTE is hands-on learning, and it engages students in a way that sitting at a desk all day long doesn't always do, she says. By exploring interest at an early age, students can avoid declaring a major for college, only to get to campus and realize that they don't want to do it. Additionally, she points to soft skills that students get through hands-on learning, such as working in teams and customer service. Reed Rogers is well known among his peers at Zoo School. He is a senior who comes from a different high school than the students he laughs and studies with. He shares the same love of animals with them and has conquered social anxiety because of them. I wouldn't say that I'm the most popular kid at high school, but here, just having a small class and being with the same group of people for 2 years, you really get to know them, says Reed, who dreams of attending Ohio State University and becoming a conservationist. It makes it easier, so you can be more comfortable around them. He looks at ease as he and classmate Xander Collin film their keeper talk in front of their moose encampment. They have taken their 3-minute talk a step further and switched up the scenery from the lone male moose at the zoo in the background to a bridge over a pond with ducks in the water, to a metal statue of a moose where they sit, pose for pictures, and make funny faces. "This is fun," Reed says with a smile. "I've never personally thrived in the traditional bunch of desks in a room, sit down, be quiet, and listen kind of lecture," he adds. The hands-on experience that he gets from working with zookeepers and staff is what he was looking for. "It's very interactive," he says, "and for me personally, that makes learning a lot more fun and a lot less boring, and it makes me excited to come here." Our next article is titled, "Huge Audience of WNBA Finals in New York Caps Record-Breaking Season." The New York Liberty finally won its first WNBA championship after beating the Minnesota Lynx 67-62 in overtime of a decisive Game 5 on October 20th. The first three games of the series each had over a million viewers and huge crowds in attendance. This article was written by Doug Feinberg. As confetti fell and Frank Sinatra's New York, New York blared through the arena, the New York Liberty celebrated the end of a long odyssey. The team that always fell short, starting from their days in Madison Square Garden through detours to Radio City Music Hall and Westchester County Center, finally found their way to the top. Start spreading the news, indeed. There's finally a pro basketball championship in New York again, after a 67-62 overtime win over Minnesota in Game 5 of the WNBA Finals the night of October 20th. This series has been a fitting conclusion to a record-breaking season for the league. All five games came down to the last few possessions and have included two overtime games and a last-second shot, which have led to record ratings. The first three games each had over a million viewers on average, with the audience growing for each contest. The series set both the overall attendance record for a WNBA Finals as well as the average attendance mark. The games also had huge crowds in attendance. Selling out the stadium, 18,090 watched the night of October 20th. "I've been manifesting this moment for a while. There's no feeling like it," Brianna Stewart said of the WNBA Finals win. "Credit to Minnesota. They gave us a tough series. The fans have been amazing everywhere we've gone. To bring a championship to New York, first ever in franchise history, it's an incredible feeling. I can't wait to continue to celebrate with the city. It's going to be bonkers." Jonquel Jones scored 17 points to lead New York, which was one of the original franchises in the league. The Liberty made the WNBA Finals five times before, losing each one, including last season. This time, they wouldn't be denied, although it took an extra 5 minutes. With stars Brianna Stewart and Sabrina Ionescu struggling on offense, other players stepped up. Leone Fivich started off overtime with a three-pointer, and then Nayara Sabali, who finished with 13 points, had a steal for a layup to make it 65-60 and bring the sellout crowd to a frenzied state. "Whoever scores in overtime first usually wins," Liberty coach Sandy Brondello said. Minnesota didn't score in overtime until Kayla McBride hit two free throws with 1:51 left. The Lynx missed all six of their field goal attempts in overtime. After Miss Ionescu missed a shot with 21 seconds left, her 18th miss on 19 shot attempts, the Lynx had one last chance. But Bridget Carlton missed a three-pointer with 16 seconds left. Miss Stewart, who missed a free throw with 0.8 seconds left in the end of regulation in Game 1, hit two free throws with 10.1 seconds left in overtime to seal the victory. As the final seconds ticked off the clock, The players hugged and streamers fell from the rafters at Barclays Center. Miss Stewart and Miss Jones hugged. The two prize free agent signees 2 years ago helped get this team its first title. New York trailed by 2 in regulation when Miss Stewart was fouled with 5.2 seconds left. After a lengthy video review, Miss Stewart calmly hit 2 free throws to tie the game at 60. Minnesota had challenged the foul call, and after the game, Coach Cheryl Reeves still questioned it, saying the title was stolen from her team. Miss McBride, who finished with 21 points, had an open look for a 3, but it fell off the rim and the game went to overtime. Many of the former Liberty greats were in the audience, including Teresa Weatherspoon, who hit a half-court heave in the 1999 WNBA Finals to force a decisive Game 3 that year. That was the last time that New York had a chance to play in a championship-deciding game until this year. Miss Jones, who was the only player on the Liberty to compete in a Game 5 before, when she was with Connecticut in 2019, earned MVP honors. "I could never dream of this. You know how many times I've been denied. It was delayed. I am so happy to do it here," she said. Nafisa Collier scored 22 points to lead Minnesota before fouling out with 13 seconds left in OT. The Lynx were trying for a record 5th WNBA title, breaking a tie with the Seattle Storm and Houston Comets. Minnesota won 4 titles from 2011 to 2017 behind the core group of Lindsay Whalen, Simone Augustus, Rebecca Brunson, Sylvia Foles, and Maya Moore. That was the team's last appearance in the WNBA Finals until this year. "Congratulations to the Liberty on their first championship," Miss Reeves said. "It took them 28 years. Congrats to them. We were that close to our 5th. It just didn't happen." This is the first time since 2019 that the WNBA Finals have gone the distance. Since the league switched to a best-of-5 format in 2005, 7 other series have gone to a Game 5, and the home team had won 5 of those previous contests, including in 2019. Liberty fan Spike Lee was courtside over an hour before tip-off, chatting with the media while wearing his Ionescu jersey. Once Miss Ionescu finished warming up pregame, the pair had a brief exchange and hugged. This story was reported by the Associated Press. Our next story, in Europe, a nod to honest leaders. The story behind a slim victory for Moldova's vote on joining the European Union reveals a deeper embrace of democratic values. This article was written by the Monitor's editorial board. One of Europe's most crucial votes this year, an October 20th referendum in Moldova on whether to eventually join the European Union, ended up with a squeak-by approval of just over 40%. The slim margin of victory came as a shock. Years of polling indicated strong support for EU membership in one of the continent's smallest and poorest countries. Yet a closer look suggests that the win was quite remarkable, only confirming why so many countries in Eastern Europe seek to live under EU values. An estimated 10% of Moldova's electorate was targeted with bribes from inside Russia to vote against EU membership, according to officials. Such wholesale corruption of low-income citizens, costing some $16 million in bribe money, is exactly why a majority of Moldovans want to join the graft-fighting bloc. Without the bribery, the victory margin might have been much wider. After the referendum, Moldova's pro-EU and Harvard-trained president, Maia Sandu, explained the task ahead. "Unfortunately, the justice system failed to do enough to prevent vote rigging and corruption," she told a news conference. "Here, too, we must draw a line, correct what went wrong, and learn the lesson. We heard you. We know we must do more to fight corruption." Perhaps just as remarkable in the referendum was the relatively high turnout of voters under 35 years old. That rings true across many countries in the region. A new survey of young people ages 14 to 29 in a dozen countries from Albania to Turkey finds that nearly two-thirds say their biggest concern is corruption, even more than employment, climate change, and other worries. In other words, a desire for honesty and transparency in government is driving change in these countries as it is in Moldova. The prospect of EU membership maintains a high level of optimism among young people in non-member countries, stated the survey, which was commissioned by the Friedrich Ebert Stiftung, a German foundation. Most young people in the region adhere to democratic values, despite a general decline in trust in democracy as the preferred form of government. One notable find among youth, those with higher levels of fear of joblessness share a stronger belief in democracy as a favorable political system. As seen in Moldova's vote, young people in Southeast Europe embrace pro-democratic values, especially civic equality and rule of law that nurture honest governance. Our next article is entitled Beyond the Gender Gap: Presidential Politics is a Masculinity Contest. This article was written by Ali Martin. As early voting gets underway across the United States, one political divide has become clear. Most men prefer former President Donald Trump. Most women prefer Vice President Kamala Harris. That gap reflects party narratives throughout this election season, with Democrats leaning into issues like abortion, access, and economic equality, while Republicans have evoked traditional gender roles in discussing gun violence, child care, and family planning. This gender gap, while significant, goes back decades. What this campaign underscores is Americans' broader preference beyond gender for masculinity in the nation's highest office. The president doesn't have to necessarily be a man, but voters are still really liking a masculine presence at that level, says Lindy Meeks, a University of Oklahoma professor specializing in political communication and gender. Power projection. Trump stumper Tucker Carlson at a rally this week implicitly referred to his presidential candidate as Dad. He unfurled a metaphor in which, when Dad comes home, he deals with his misbehaving children, implicitly the Democrats. You've been a bad little girl, and you're getting a vigorous spanking. It capped a campaign laden with hyper-masculine images, from appearances with pro wrestlers to frequent use of aggressive language, including a recent vulgar reference to the late golf legend Arnold Palmer's anatomy. Former President Trump has consistently connected with male voters who value a certain type of crude masculine power figure. And Friday, he is set to record an interview with Joe Rogan, the podcaster wildly popular with young male audiences, including young black men. Ms. Harris is walking a finer line. Attempting to appeal to men while keeping her base among women, her choice of Tim Walz as a running mate brought some balance to her femininity, but she's also played up her more masculine qualities as California's top cop and as a gun owner. And this week, former President Barack Obama rallied supporters on her behalf in Detroit alongside rapper Eminem, making a pointed appeal to young men to support the Democratic candidate. We are running out of time, so we'll wrap up the article here. You have been listening to the Christian Science Monitor, read by Daniel Williams.
The content featured in this recording may not reflect the views of AfterSight or the presenter. For questions, concerns, or editorial feedback regarding the Christian Science Monitor, please contact them directly at customerservice@csmonitor.com or call 617-450-2300 Monday through Friday.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.